Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
I'm 19 Keys, and this is
high-level conversation.
The library. The library.
You're thinking about middle-class expansion. You talked about trades, right? Now, I know this, you know, Gen Z and the other generations, they don't want to be plumbers. They don't want trades, right? America is hyper-demoralized, and, you know, a lot of the physicality, which comes from more so, you know, the psychology of a man, right? He's going to utilize his hands to build, to create, to do things. The generation, let's just be honest, is a little more have the psychology of, you know, to be more feminine, right? When you think about the different archetypes, right? That now represents the males of America. Today is more of, you know, as they say, beta male, right? A lot of the views on masculinity from a young male perspective are not positive. So you push the ideas of like toxic masculinity without giving a representation of mature masculinity or what you would consider healthy. So the young boys, in today's time, want to be more gender fluid, if you will. They don't see themselves as men because there's also not many rites of passage. And the media doesn't give them that many representations. When I say media, I'm talking about entertainment industry, Hollywood, et cetera, right? Of the type of man that they would want to become. And then just the social circles of influence on social media within itself. This is why you get popular, you know, people who rise and take that position as like a father figure. And they may be controversial, but the young men feel like they don't get leadership anywhere else. So they're going to be more prone to follow those type of examples. If you're telling somebody, be a man, this is how you get women, this is how you get respected. This is how you become more confident. This is how you get money. When the rest of society is saying being a man is the issue with the world. So there's going to be a natural defiance that goes with that, which creates a natural alliance to people who push it. Whew. Talking and walking. But at the same time, the things that they want to do, right, are, you know, involving so-called passion pursuits and things of that nature. 50% of high schoolers have said that they want to be influencers, right? They want to utilize social media. But at the same time, it's very hard to build wealth on social media. There's constant increased censorship, right? Platform algorithms are constantly changing. And when it comes to job creation and, you know, reskilling America, that's going to have to go into, number one, education, right? Because schools are not teaching relevant things for children to learn, right? In the first place, they should come out of high school ready for the world, right? And if they want to pursue additional education, they shouldn't have to go into debt to do it, because half of Black wealth is lost to college debt. So we even know that we're taught, you know, there is a direct correlation between education and wealth. This is why we see Asian families have the highest gross income, right? Then it's Jewish, then it's white, then it's Black, right? But as Black and white, we always compare ourselves to each other. But one of the issues that we have is a lack of family. That's going to start from neighborhoods and having opportunities, right? Because creativity minus opportunity is going to lead to criminality as well. There's a lot of energy that this youth have and they have nowhere to put it. And this world, the anxiety that they're getting about the future is constantly increasing because the average American don't know what the future of America is. So now you go to the poor class and ask them what's their future. They don't even have the ability to think of the future. So when I asked about the middle class expansion, I want to know really about your in-depth understanding about job creation as far as like where is the opportunities going to come from for the average American? And there's going to have to be some direct correlation between laws because the laws are set up right now for all the wealth to be concentrated at the top. Right. So where is how is that going to change what a person be like? I understand why I'm going to vote for RFK. We about to get some wealth. We about to get some money. I see a bright future there. Right. And it has to be some sort of action plan to where it'd be like, all right, number one, he sounds like he understands the poor middle class America. Right. And there's a big job, right, of changing things within 4 years, number one. I'm not sure if that's ever possible, but that's the way America is set up, right? Give another guy a shot every 4 years. But I want you to go a little more in depth. And if you can show people, right, your high level ability, right, to as a businessman, because I know you are a lawyer, an environmental lawyer, and I want to get into some of the beautiful, positive things that you've done. America is a corporation. You're going to be CEO. Right. So I want to know your business plan for America as far as job creation and, you know, skill development, because Americans do not know what to do next. And the IQ of this generation for the first time has been shown to decrease. Right. As they scale and they look at the IQ of generations every year, this generation is not as smart, but we have more access to tools than ever before. Right. So where's your plan when it comes to taking wealth and concentrating it towards the bottom so that people can see growth? Otherwise, black Americans that start making money, they look at Republicans and say, well, I want money. So they go tax incentivized. We look at Democrats and say, well, I'm tired of giving loyalty to Democrats, because even though we vote for them every year, because they tell us that, you know, it's lesser of the two evils, we rather choose revolution. And for most people, revolution is no vote. So how do you then convince those people you're going to reunite the people under a plan to make more people patriotic again? And in order to do that, they're going to have to believe in a country, and they're going to have to believe in a leader that can lead the country to prosperity.
Let me make a couple of points and answer your question. One is just a footnote, is you talked about Gen Z and millennials who want jobs essentially as computer technicians, or those are the first jobs that are going to disappear. Now, there's a lot of entrepreneurial opportunities that are available on the internet for influencers and to start small businesses. This is one of the reasons I've opposed the abolition of TikTok, because there's hundreds of thousands of kids now that are making money. It's a gateway for them. And we need to keep those opportunities. And also, I'm just against any kind of incursions on free speech. I think that's critical. The free flow of information is critical to the survival of our and the flourishing of our democracy. My father, in 1966, he was senator of New York. His brother was killed in 63. He ran for Senate in New York in 64. He was shattered. He ran for Senate. He walked in 1966 through the poorest community in New York, which is Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. And he saw something in that community that inspired him, which was, it was an unusual community because of all the indicia of urban poverty. It was beating the nation. You know, I mean, there are places like Oakland and Watts and south side of Chicago now we're in the same shape, but there was a high crime, high deterioration in families, low graduation rates, all the things that you associated with poverty. But there was something unusual in Bed-Stuy, which was there was a very high percentage of home ownership of, and most of the communities, black communities in this country, the homes in those communities are absentee owned. They're owned by landlords who do not live in those communities. And that is sucking money out of those communities. At Bed-Stuy, there were people who had lived in houses there since the American Civil War, and they were proud of their community. He saw that there was, you know, the houses were, although they were humble, they were painted, the front doors were painted, people were on the stoops, people had a feeling of community, there were flower pots. that had flowers, they cared about their community. And the problem is that they didn't have access to capital. Is that, you know, there were no banks there that would loan money. They were redlined by insurance companies. They were redlined by the banks, so that if you wanted to improve your home, you couldn't do that. You couldn't get a home improvement loan. And there was also a problem in those communities where there was no accrued business knowledge. So my father wasn't in business, but his father was, and he had gone to Harvard, and he knew people were in business. So if he ever wanted to start a business, he could call up a friend and say, how do you do inventories? How do you pay your taxes? What kind of accountant should I hire? And all of these, you know, all of the questions that you would need to answer, he had friends who could help him. But in those communities, they were on their own. So my father went back to Bed-Stuy, and he went back again and again and again, and he said, this is going to be my life's project of figuring out what works to rebuild a community, not to impose things from outside, but to allow people the opportunity to follow their own, you know, impulses for self-improvement, for entrepreneurship. And he began leaning on the banks to end the redlining in that community, those communities. And then he brought business leaders. He brought Andre Meyer, the CEO of Lazard Frere. He brought Tom Watson, the CEO of IBM, and many, many other big Wall Street billionaires. And he got them to each commit to one day a month or one day a week to spend in Bed-Stuy meeting with local leaders, teaching them how to run business. When he walked through that community, there were hundreds of stores. They were all boarded up on Fulton Street. Arthur Schlesinger, when he wrote his biography of my father after my father's death, said, when my father was not at home with his 11 kids, that the one place he wanted to be more than any other was Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And he fell in love with that community, and he built Restoration Plaza, which was an old milk dairy plant, bottling plant, and he made it the centerpiece. And when he died in 68, I took his place on the board, and I served on that board for almost 40 years. And today, if you walk through down Fulton Street or Atlantic Avenue, every storefront is buzzing, and there is commerce that is spilling out onto the sidewalks. These are Black-owned businesses, largely. And it became what he started, what he called a community development corporation. He started it as a model. There's now 2,000 of them around the country based upon what we were able to accomplish in Bed-Stuy. So I feel like I have a really good idea about how to restore these communities in ways that's not top down, but in ways that funnels capital into the community and knowledge, business knowledge, to allow people in those communities to take care of themselves and to lift themselves. And, you know, I think the liberal ideology today is that we have to stop racism by censoring people, by canceling people, by teaching people not to be racist, et cetera. To me, that's a dead end. Racism is just part of, you know, of tribalism.
America.
But not just America. You know, it's the 20,000 generations that humanity spent wandering the African savannah in little tribal groups, warring with anybody who didn't look like them.
But
right?
That wasn't racism. Racism
is hardwired. It's like, kind of hardwired.
But white is like a specific customization of the American complex.
Yeah, but it's ultimately a much older impulse in America. It's everywhere, and it's tribalism. And
it was more, I would say, classism in different eras.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Okay.
Because even when you go to places where the Moors thrive and, you know, they were teaching Europeans, there were so-called Africans and Europeans getting along and of different colors, yeah. Right? And then noble classes and things of that nature. But when we look at, like I heard Jordan Peterson talk about the so-called myth of white supremacy or white privilege, which to me is a fallacy and it's on its face because the word white is a privilege itself, right? Because white is a construct that unifies a certain people. Because if you go back to Bacon Rebellion, then it speaks on how you keep people divided, right? And so for me, it's a systematic creation by those who are wealthy, the government, the 1%, however you want to look at it, right? To create a privilege that creates a commonality so that they don't see that, hey, you in the poor class, they up there. Instead, we're divided by all of these different titles so that the people never look at it. It's the people and then it's the system, right? So the word white itself is a privilege. Right.
Okay. Rules,
because it didn't exist before a certain time.
Yeah, it's an argument that we probably aren't going to resolve here, and that I don't.
I'm not trying to resolve it. Just some facts.
One way or the other, whether it's America or not. But,
just some facts.
What do we do? That I was raised in the 1960s.
Just like backyard barbecues or a day at the pool, the Three Rivers Festival has always been a part of our summer fun. And the festival returns July 12th to the 20th. It kicks off with the annual Three Rivers Festival Parade. Browse art in the park with local artisans. Bring the family to Children's Fest. Stroll through Junk Food Alley. And don't forget about the festival concerts at the Hoosier Lottery stage with live music from nationally renowned acts. You can buy your concert tickets or check out a schedule of events at ThreeRiversFestival.org. Don't miss the best summer experience in Fort Wayne, the Three Rivers Festival.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
Uncle was the first Irish Catholic president of the United States. There was tremendous anti-Catholic prejudice then. The Ku Klux Klan had a resurgence during his election. It was a huge issue. Should a Catholic ever be allowed to serve as presidency? I was called names when I was a kid, a mackerel snatcher, a mick, all of these, you know, derogatory names. When people called me that, I never internalized it. I would think, that guy's got a problem. That guy's weird because he's saying that to me. I never thought, oh, I'm inferior. I'm, you know, and the reason for that was because I had confidence, because I had an education. I had connections in my family. I had a strong family, a strong faith, and a belief in my country, a belief in my future. I was confident about my future. So prejudice had no impact on me. And that is, to me, the gift that we need to give to every Black kid in this country, that if they do encounter bigotry in their lives, that they're not affected by it. They don't internalize it. They have so much confidence in themselves as men, as women, that they are unaffected by racism. And the only way we're going to do that, we have to do two things to do that. One is we have to fix our educational system, which we need to do, for me, through education choice, through charter schools, by offering people the opportunity, if their school is not working for their kids, that they can take their kids out and they can put them in a school that does. So that every kid, and you know, there's these schools in New York now, Success Academy and a number of others, that are taking kids out of Black communities, and they take them by lottery, right? They're not kids who are, you know, had special parents who made the effort. They're chosen by lottery. And those schools are outperforming the best high schools in New York. Scarsdale High School, they have a higher graduation rate than Scarsdale High School. So it's not, you know, the poor performance in education has nothing to do with background, culture, poverty, race, color, melanin in their skin. It absolutely has everything to do with bad schools, right? And the way our school system is run. We can't do that anymore. We need to fix the schools. And the way we're going to fix them is through a market, which allows a parent, that doesn't say to a parent, wait another 10 years till we fix these schools. You can't tell that to people. You have to say, you can take your cut, kid, if this school isn't working for you, and you can move them to a school that does it. Number one. Number two, capital. We do not, black communities have systematically been stripped of their equity and therefore their access to capital in a million different ways. It's systematic. It's happening today. It's happening all the time. And that's what, and I saw it work, Key. I saw it work in Bed-Stuy. We can make that work across the country. And that, you know, is my program, which is targeted community repair for poor communities all over this country, not only black, but white, you know. And so, and that's now, there's other things we have to fix that specifically relate to black communities. And the biggest thing is the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And that is a direct result of two laws that were passed. And President Biden was, you know, was mm-hmm. involved in both of them in 1986. The Drug Act that we passed in 1986, and then the Omnibus Crime Bill in 94. Biden wrote both of them. And Clinton, the people who were supposed to be friends of the black community, who would actually do the most destructive things to the black community. Mm-hmm. That the 1986 Drug Act, the biggest thing, the worst thing it did, it made crack cocaine, it gave crack cocaine 100 times the prison penalties as powder cocaine. So a white kid in the suburbs who got busted for powder cocaine got 100 times the prison exposure as a black kid living a couple of miles away, okay? And then 94, the Omnibus Crime Bill, which had the super predator provisions in it, it had mandatory sentencing, mm-hmm. it had three strikes, you're out. Those two bills in 8 years doubled the black prison population. So the rate of black imprisonment from the Civil War till 1986 was pretty constant. After 1986, it increased, it doubled. And you now have, you know, one out of every four black men who have been exposed at one time or another to the prison system. And when we do that, you get hit again because now you have a record and you can't participate in the, you can't get a job, right? You can't get a decent job. And you can't participate in the political process. In many states, you're disenfranchised. And, you know, we need to immediately act on that. By either giving pardons or stripping the records of all the people who were convicted of nonviolent crimes, particularly drug crimes. A lot of these are marijuana, you know, and minor drug offenses. They shouldn't have a criminal record. You know, drug addiction, as I know, I was a heroin addict for 14 years. It's a disease. It's something that we have to address through treatment options and not through incarceration and permanent lifetime punishment that sends you back into that destructive cycle. Oh, those are the things that I think, you know, in answer to your question, those are the things that we need to be focusing on to, rather than, I think, some of the, you know, the sort of more ephemeral, you know, things that I think liberal doctrine is now telling us about, that we need to be focusing on the economic issues and removing the stigma of prison and stopping. I mean, you know, one of the things is that if you get suspended from school or you get school discipline, that goes on your prison record. Mm. So people are just seeing that for the rest of your life. You know, and you don't, in a white community, that doesn't happen to you. But you are branded from when you're a kid as a troublemaker, as a criminal. And it's, and that is one of the biggest anchors that on the growth and the robustness and the, you know, the success of the black community in this country. If you take all the men out of the black community, which is what's happening systematically, you're going to destroy that community, and it has been systematically destroyed.
100%. And it gets me to think about, you know, the 13th Amendment, that, you know, once you become a prisoner, you become a slave. So black Americans often view that as, you know, just another route to slavery that never ended. So our community has been disproportionately affected by that for the last 500 years, and we're still going through it because I got a brother in prison right now. I got a younger brother that's in jail right now. So it's the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, right, that changes your trajectory towards life. And it's not even just the schooling, right? When you go up, either lack of father, lack of proper education, and you go up in a household where you experience all of these different levels of trauma, my adversity is going to be completely different than the average person. So now I have a lot more to get over. For trauma, for some people, it will turn you into, you know, a hyperachiever, right? And other people, it makes them collapse inside themselves.
What do you think allowed you to come out of that environment? You think it was your early education, your parents, without that, you know, with a really clear idea of who you are and, you know, what it means to be a man?
That's a good question. I think about it a lot because I got seven brothers. I grew up in Oakland and St. Louis. And a lot of people that grew up in the same exact environments as I did didn't survive. Most of them, 90% of them, I will say, are dead, in jail, disease, homeless, on drugs. So it's like, even when I go back hometown, there's almost nobody to visit. The people from my childhood are no longer there. So for me, I think I have an outlier mentality at the same time. I got a growth mindset. You know, growing up in a Black Muslim environment, being taught how to be a soldier, right? Taking things as challenges versus looking at them as problems that's happening to me. You know, being taught that I was a god, developing that complex of thinking. You know, I just always looked at everything, you know, as something that was growing me for this ultimate destiny.
Yeah.
So I would say, more than anything, it's the mindset that I observed from men that I respected and the ideals that I got from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan. But then, you know, there's other people that got those same ideas, but they didn't fare as well. That's why there's a part of it to where I can't generalize it on the rest of society because everybody don't have that outlier mentality, right? I feel like I was blessed with a certain idea about myself and a certain self-image. And I made a choice at a very young age that my life meant more. I done been in times where I done been in shootouts and the very thought in my mind, and I'm talking about in high school, I'm like, I'm not going to die right here because I'm destined for something more, right? These are things that stuck with me throughout my whole life to where I had to always figure out, how do I make sense of what I'm going through? How do I transmute that into something else? And so a part of that is a demonstration of seeing men, seeing what's possible, right? Self-education, because I never finished college, but I never stopped learning, right? And then focusing on developing a superior mindset and asking myself, you know, what does it mean to be a man? I constantly take myself through the rites of passage to become a man because I never just assume that just because I reach a certain age, I'm a man. I always thought about the trials and tribulations and the self-development and the values and the principles that it takes to be a man. And so as I accomplished those throughout different periods in life, that's when I can give myself credit. Like, all right, I see you growing. But everybody don't have that because everybody needs on a range properly. You know, I got a vast thesis about how when you grow up in certain environments and you're not told that you are significant, you're not told, you're not given credit for your efforts, you're not shown love, you miss those needs of like significance. So when you grow up, you need that more, you need love more. So you seek that in different places that ain't good for you. Me, I never sought that. I never felt like I needed more of my father's love. I never felt like I needed more of my mother's love. I felt like I needed to grow and I needed to challenge myself and accomplish something in life. So I don't think everybody has that. Some people, they seek, I need people to see me for who I am. I need to be a part of something. I was always, I'm gonna build it if I don't see it.
I was always, well, if you told me I'm this, then that means I can do this. So shit, I'm gonna get it done. So, you know, that's a mindset shift. And that comes from expansion, like, I mean, through exposure. And so the beauty of my whole entire life is I've been exposed to different perspectives. I'm having this conversation with you because I'm always seeking different perspectives. The whole point of high-level conversations is to provide exposure that allows people to think. And I believe a thinking man is a real free man.
Nah, I was seriously up all night. You know what I mean? I took a couple of drops of this, and I think I took it too late, right? I took it probably around like 5 o'clock. I didn't think it was going to keep me up to like 2-3 o'clock. But it was good though, because I was doing hella work. Like, I was knocking it out because I had to do a lot of stuff on the back end for the show. But the disclaimer on this one, don't take this if you want to goddamn be focused. If you don't want to be focused all day long, just knocking it out with no distractions. Because my mind was calm. I had my system ready to go. I was energized. And I was just boom, 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 boom. And once I got in that flow, I couldn't be distracted nor slanted nor taken off. You feel me? That supermind really have you up there going. It's like Viagra for the brain. It had me definitely mentally up all night, for sure. Because it almost got to a point where it felt like I couldn't tell when I was supposed to go to sleep because I didn't get no drowsiness. But then I realized that once I got into bed, you know, I was able to naturally just fall into a sleep. So it was still good. It wasn't one of the ones that just, you know, had me with insomnia. It would just basically tell me when you want to go to sleep, you can. But beyond that, that supermind had me working. Yeah, this my fix. I don't need nothing else for real.
Keys, and this is high-level conversation.
Library.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.